evening. I thought I'd just reflect a bit on my lifestyle as a way of indicating what the Buddha considered was important in terms of lifestyle. Now, obviously, you can't all be monks and nuns, and I'm sure very few even want to do that. But it is interesting to maybe consider the elements that the Buddha thought were important in a lifestyle as a way of just looking at your own lifestyle, I suppose. Just what the whole training that the monastic order was offered, what that's about. And why I think this way, because I've spent this last year with my mother, which has been a very beautiful year. It's been so rewarding. But I've lived in monasteries for 29, 30 years, and now 1 year I live in a condo, in a lay situation. So it's quite a interesting sort of anthropological study for me of living a different way. And I still live as a monk, but I also do things which monks normally don't do. To take care of my mother, which is fine within my discipline. And also, I've never been so plugged into media. Ottawa Citizen and CNN and BBC and Guardian Weekly and the whole schlamazel. But it has also been interesting for me just to be with a culture and its issues and problems for one whole year. Because in the monastery, newspaper once a week is a big deal, and no TV, and so we're very, very, very much out of contact with the sort of issues of any society. We feel them more through individuals as we talk to people. But one of the things I've obviously noticed is how much of the public discussion around religion seems to me has nothing to do with religion. The sort of socio-political issues that very rarely do I hear about, like, the heart of religion, what religion is about. But our social political actions are informed by our hearts, obviously, and then we act from our hearts in public ways and social ways. But the very point of religion, the heart of religion, we rarely hear that in public talk. And I guess maybe that is the heart of religion is for the temple or the church or the synagogue or the mosque or whatever. But what I could see this year was that how very different the old Buddhism was, the way it was set up. Because in the time of the Buddha, there were Brahmin priests who were the sort of religious officials of the culture who did rituals and so on. And they're also the mendicants, the wanderers, the shamans, shramanas, who wandered about and who were religious seekers and who offered whatever insights they had to whoever wanted to listen. And they'd gather on full moons or no moons, and people would come around and they'd discuss various kinds of things. So the tradition of like the contemplative tradition was very unformed and unstructured. So the Buddha arose within that kind of religious structure, and he wasn't a Brahmin, so he took up the wandering life, and he was very charismatic, obviously, and he had some profound insight, and then he offered that to people, and people came to him, and he was a great walker. Always, walking from village to village and offering teaching, and people would feed him, offer him a meal, he'd be with other monks, and so it went for 45 years of teaching. And then, of course, like any great teacher, men and women wanted to practice close to him, they wanted to be with him. And because they wanted to be with him, a monastic order was formed, and that monastic order grew, and the wandering life changed to some wandering, but a lot of stability. It grew into monasticism. And then from those original beginnings, you have the whole long history of Buddhism, where Buddhism was supported by became the religion of the establishment, where it was supported by kings, and then this very unique sort of creation in Tibet, where the temporal power and the spiritual power are one person, which is a huge way from that original manifestation of Buddhist practice. So there's all these kind of cultural overlays, which if you read Buddhist history, you can kind of get a sense of where it moved and what countries it touched. But the Buddha never legislated for the lay people. You know, he never said who could get married or who couldn't get married. He didn't make any statements about pro-life or pro-abortion. He talked about killing, certainly. But those kinds of decisions that you find being discussed, that was really up to the laity. But where he did legislate very strongly was with the monastic community. Their very strong kind of legislation about what we can and we can't do. So he created a kind of culture and society within the larger society. So the monks and nuns had a certain rule that they lived by, and that rule grew over the years as different problems arose and different complexities arose. And so, like now, in England, we're having an elders' council meeting in West Sussex, where the abbesses of our monasteries are discussing various problems that we have right now, various issues. One of the issues is the internet. How do you use that thing and not just have monks and nuns sitting around on the internet? So it's very dynamic, very, very changing. But we legislate that for ourselves. We don't say, you know, we don't make a decision and say to all the laity, all right, 5 minutes of internet every 2 days. So it doesn't work that way. So it's sort of a different, it's a different kind of a model that, say, like maybe Catholicism or various forms of Islam. But then Christianity has different models, and Islam has different models, and Hinduism have different models. So people often ask me, you know, what's the rule for a layperson? Well, the only thing a monk or a nun can offer is good. Well, this is the sort of suggestion around moral precepts, or this is the suggestion that the monastics use for their life, and then it's up to the laity to sort of ponder that and see, well, you know, what would be appropriate. So if a monk was asked about some some social issue, he might comment from, like I might comment from my own experience, but I would never say, you know, I would never legislate that, because it's just not my culture. My culture is monastic culture. So it's an interesting historical development when you get this society running parallel to normal society, which gives it actually quite a, it acts as a kind of interesting mirror to society at large. It's these kind of monastic sinners just sort of bubbling along, going through their problems and difficulties. We have all kinds of issues that we deal with, and we deal with them, of course, in our own structures, in our own laws. What I'd like to reflect on this evening is some of the basic elements that the Buddha suggested for the spiritual life, because monastic life is based on certain elements which are very, very helpful for the spiritual life. One of the curious things about the whole coming into, say monastic life is there, one usually has a very strong sense of a goal, because one wants to kind of get what the Buddha got, get enlightened and get what the teachers got. And of course, as soon as you go in there, they say, well, you forget about that, because if you're greedy for enlightenment, you're already trapped into greed. So you have already, you know, you come into this life, you come into the life with this, you know, because to take the robe, you have to have a huge aspiration. It's not an easy life. And so you have, you know, I want to get the big number, and I want to, you know, a couple of years max. That's what I'll do. And then, you know, the old monks look at you. But So it's interesting how the teacher's teaching is presented. It's presented as, well, just look at your discontent. And I think that's absolutely brilliant. Because of our at least my greed for attainment, I certainly, you know, I read that stuff, oh yeah. And the teacher says, no, yeah, that's all very well, that, you know, but why do you suffer? What's the nature of your discontent? Why is there stress or whatever? So that kind of constant reflection is a very, very basic part of monastic life, that one takes responsibility for the discontent in one's heart and tries to see, what is it that I, you know, why can't be I peaceful here? Why can't I, whatever? So that kind of theme, based on the Four Noble Truths, that theme of discontent, the cause, and the letting go of the cause, that's this sort of underlining contemplative theme that's just going on all the time. Whether you're sewing your robes or you're doing some chanting, whatever, that underlying theme. And having that theme in the mind creates this kind of contemplative resonance in the mind. You know, whatever's going on, whatever difficulties I'm having, it's something I got to figure out. But that is done within a body of law. So if one of the monastics goes against the common principles that we all agree upon, then we address that. So you have both. You have a very strong rule, right? You have a body of law, but also you have this taking responsibility. Now, if you just had kind of taking responsibility for your own suffering and you didn't have a common agreement, well, you could be very much taken advantage of, couldn't you? But if you just had some common agreement, but we had no reflective kind of capacity, then we'd just be sort of conforming, wouldn't we? You kind of conform to the rules and you'll be happy, which is ridiculous, of course. It doesn't work. And so one of the elements in this kind of contemplative part is surrendering to a rule, surrendering to a structure, surrendering to a form, giving yourself to a certain lifestyle. That is agreed upon by everyone. Everyone has to do it. From the most junior to the most senior, the abbot can't go changing the rules and saying, well, you know, you guys do that, but because I'm really attained and I've been around longer than you, I'll get two of those and you can have one. So it's very, very clear. Everyone lives by the same rule. And this what I found tremendously helpful was this kind of, finally I could just give up to something. I didn't have to rearrange the structures, make the rules, or leave when I wanted to leave, or you know, do all of that. I had something that I could give up to. And within that giving up, I mean, I got a lot. The lay societies were very generous, and I got requisites, and I got teaching. But I also didn't like it. You know, it's a lot of restlessness and a lot of, complaining in my mind about how I should, you know, Buddhism should be changed in Thailand and all kind, you know, all those kind of conceited things that people get into. But because there was a structure and there was this inner contemplation of discontent, it became very, very obvious that I'm not going to change Thai Buddhism. I'm not going to change the Buddha's rule. So either I figure out the discontent, or I leave, or I just keep suffering in the discontent. So there's this huge kind of taking of responsibilities. I've often thought, well, okay, lay life, what's the equivalent of that? Well, it must be vocation, family, whatever, that there are structures that you have to give up to. And it's that aspect of giving up and watching the discontent which is so very helpful. So I ended up in, like, you know, I ended up with a very, very good teacher, but he would often send me away. So, you know, Ajahn Chah was a very, very brilliant, charismatic teacher, and just being around him, you were kind of high, which was lovely. And of course, he saw that, and he'd chuck you out. So, I ended up spending 10 months with this nice, uninspiring monk. There was only five of us there, and he had three nuns. One was his mother, which I thought was great. You know, food is very, and there was nothing to inspire me anymore. You know, there wasn't the great charismatic Ajahn Chah. There was just Ajahn Si, who, he was a good man, but I found very boring. and chewed too much betel nut, and so. And he would, he had this habit of, we'd have these all-night sittings, and we had these large raised chairs, where the monk who's going to give the teaching gets up on a chair, and he was a very small monk, and he would talk for 2 hours, then he'd fall asleep. And he'd wake up and start talking again. He'd do this all night. So my logical mind said, well, this is ridiculous. I need some sleep. Or then I just feel self-righteous. So, you know, all kinds of stuff. But always the reflection was, okay, you chose this. This is where your teacher sent you. Why do you suffer? So superficially, you know, there was all the kind of conceit and arrogance and anger and restlessness and all that. But underlying it, fortunately, you know, every now and then a voice would surface saying, it's your problem. You know, why do you suffer? Why do you suffer? And that's what the teachers would ram home. Ajahn Chah would just ram that theme home. Just keep, you know, there was no esoteric teaching. Why do you suffer? Why do you suffer? Why do you suffer? And that kind of constant badgering. And in situations which weren't according to my own preferences, which weren't according to my own desires, and yet they were good, they were wholesome. So having said that, if they were unwholesome, you know, if there's some big rip-off going, I would have left, obviously. But they're very wholesome. They're very, you know, they're very moral situations, so the structure is very good. But then that became really, really kind of good practice to be there where my rational mind and logical mind said, this is ridiculous. You know, this isn't Buddhism, and what's going on? And they say, yeah, but what's that in here? That's suffering. Yeah, but it's his fault. You kind of got to come back to those themes again. Can you imagine doing that for 5 years? And that's, you know, like in monasticism, the first 5 years are not yours. It's a given. You stay with the teacher for 5 years before you can wander. Right? So you go into it. I mean, I could have disrobed any time. There's no force. But the sort of contract in your mind is, well, before you can even think about going to any monastery you want to go, you got to give 5 years. So there was this huge, huge necessity to surrender. And then within that, I could see the resistance to surrender. And then day in and day out, very edifying, very edifying, right? And so I don't know what kind of structures you have, but you can see if you're always changing the goalposts, or if you're blaming situations, it's very hard to actually contemplate suffering. But you know, given that if there's some kind of abusive person at work, you have to address that, don't you? You can't just say, "Oh, that's okay, abuse me. I'm just practicing Four Noble Truths." That's not right either, right? So lay life is much more complicated. It's not such a neat package. You know, it's not such a nice package. But the principle of being able to give up to something, I guess children would be quite an obvious one. You know, the responsibilities of children, you just have to, I suppose, I've never had children, but you just have to give up to it and give yourself to it. And then when there's a like and the dislike and all the rest of it. And within that kind of idea, there's also repetition. That's what I found. The monastic life is very boring. I can't think of anything less stimulating. I mean, you think about this. You go to Northeast and your teacher sends you to an even more boring place. You got no English books, no one to speak English with. In 10 months, there was 2 cups of sweet tea and 2 Pepsis. This was the sum total of my caffeine intake. Very, very, very simple food, okay? Hot weather. So all you got is your mind. That's all you got. And instead of learning the chanting, learning time, how much can you meditate anyway? You got to go into it. Okay, I've got 5 years to meditate. After a while, you're going to get wear down. And then after a while, it's not about control. It's not about getting rid of it. Why do I suffer? Why can't I just give up? what is it here? And after a while, there's this kind of, well, it's all right. The whole resistance to the way I think it should be, that begins to break down. Not because of some kind of stupid, some kind of naive belief, but because one sees the very nature of resistance, the existential nature of resistance within that structure. So that became then a really good lesson to kind of that echo in the mind, well, this discontent that I'm experiencing now, what do I have to give up? What do I have to let go of? And that's a very general statement, but the problem is very personal. You know, the restlessness I experienced or what have you. So that was a kind of a big part of it. Community life, say, is different than kind of living on your own. Ajahn Amaro had in his new book, he had, you know, in Tibetan tradition you do 100,000 prostrations and then you do 100,000 mantras, things like that. Well, he said community life is 100,000 frustrations. And you know, for a Westerner living in community, I just was not used to that. You know, I was used to having my own radio or, you know, doing my own thing, and all of a sudden you have to kind of share your whole life, which is a very lovely ideal. But the reality, of course, was not so very easy. But so then that was a big one, like sharing my life with beings who I normally probably never would have talked much with, because we're a pretty mixed bag of people. And our only thing in common really is trying to get enlightened. So you get this kind of mixture of people. I'm just having to open the heart to an eccentric Englishman, say. And I found this in England. I had this chap who I just could not understand. And he was part of the mind. It just confused me. It was just this kind of... And I was the abbot. So I was supposed to sort of understand. And it's this kind of confusion in my mind. And just that's confusion. So normally, you know, if I was choosing my, you know, who I want to live with or meditate with, I was not this guy. No way. And yet he's a very good man. And I probably confused him. I don't know, but so there was this necessity to open the heart to something greater than my own preconceived notions of how people should be. And there's a lot of that, like learning to open the heart in ways which aren't like, because monastics are celibate, there isn't the usual opening of the heart with children and relationships. So it's quite a difficult one, actually. So part of that is just like being much more tolerant and much more caring of beings you might not normally care for. Kind of going against the kind of patterns that was in the mind. And a big part of opening the heart was having a teacher. And this is quite often hard to find in life. But having someone that you could really kind of look at with deep respect and open your heart and listen and serve. So a lot of our training as junior monks was taking care of our teachers. Sewing a teacher's robe, or washing his feet, or getting bath water for him, and doing all these kinds of very, very ordinary things. But that was very, very beautiful, that kind of caring for someone. And that, I think that's more obvious in lay life when you have children and you have relationships, that ability to care for people, very important. Where again, it's kind of going against our selfish tendencies, isn't it? Like that surrendering to a structure or a form is like going against the selfish preferential mind, right? And then the service and the caring is also going against that tendency of just wanting life for myself. But then, of course, like the structure of monastic life is that the junior monks usually are assigned a senior monk, and they have to care for him, take care of his hut, take care of his alms bowl. If he's got any holes in his robe, sew the holes holes up, stitch it, and if his robe is worn out, sew him a new robe. Very, very, very kind of, very, very good for men, I think, you know, to serve in that kind of way. But then I'd end up being given, you know, a senior monk who I thought slept too much, or, you know, I thought was, you know, ate too much betel nut, or fell asleep during the meditations when I was awake. So I had to, you know, then I had to serve people who were, they were okay, but they didn't inspire me. And serving Ajahn Chah was a piece of cake. Everyone just rushed to serve him because he was so charismatic and so brilliant in helping you. But then there was, you know, Jack at the end there. the monk no one noticed. And that was also very, very lovely to kind of, to go beyond the need for charisma and that, just to look at a human being and not make judgments, and just to serve someone because it's the right thing to do, because it's the appropriate thing to do. And that was very, very heart-opening. But within that, of course, there is this, like, okay, that's the structure, that's the form, then there's the resistance, right? Oh, this guy, I don't want to wash his bowl, this kind of arrogance or whatever in the mind. And just kind of seeing, what's the cause of suffering? Well, the cause of suffering is he fell asleep in the meditation and I shouldn't serve him. No, and you kind of come back. So the rationalization of suffering, you know, all that. No, what's the cause? You keep coming back to the heart, seeing the heart close and learning to open it. So service, I think, in the context is very important, I think, in the spiritual life. That whole sense of that. Like now with my mother, I'm so grateful to be able to serve. I mean, it's really just a fabulous opportunity. I get great points with other mothers. Other monks' mothers, I meet them and say, wow, I like this guy. But it's not that. It's like I'm getting more from it. Much. I try to tell that to my mother and she says, oh, shut up. She's being a Buddhist. But really, it's true, isn't it? Isn't it true when, you know, when you have someone you can give to, isn't it like a marvelous kind of thing? I mean, we can get burnt out and so on. You know, there are those issues too. But it's a service, I think, that. And that's also in that vein of giving up, letting go. A very important part of monastic life is the sustained training. You know, the sustained training of the mind in various ways. The obvious ways, like sustained training in meditation. Just like morning, evening, like it or not, you're in the meditation hall. And you just do it. You just kind of go there because that's the honorable thing to do. And you know, you want to go maybe in the beginning 20% of the time, maybe 50%. Oftentimes you don't want to go. You feel like it's too hot. You know, your knees are sore. You work too much. You didn't work enough. You didn't have a shower. You need a shower. Your mind just rationalizes why you don't want to meditate. You meditate. So that famous line, if you want to meditate, meditate. If you don't want to meditate, meditate. Just keep going. And that kind of persistent practice is very powerful. And all of us know that, whether it's music or yoga or carpentry or, you know, whatever you do, that day in and day out practice. And, you know, we always say, I practice religiously. You know, that. Now, it can't just be obsessed. It has to be with wisdom. But that is incomparable in any walk of life. So that, again, like daily life practice, how much time do you create in your mind for stopping? I guess stopping is the big issue. It's not just about this, although samadhi is very important in Buddhism, but it's that, just that whole restlessness of our culture, of doing, of filling the mind, and always getting and becoming, and stop. And whether it's canoeing or what, I mean, just stop. Whether it's with nature, going for a walk, stop. It's very, very important, very valuable. And then, of course, if one can take that stopping into cultivating a meditation object, be it choiceless awareness, be it practices of the heart, be it the breath, they're very, from what I gather talking with fellow monks or lay people, it's very hard, you know, cultivating a meditation object. So it does take a lot of training. And I don't think, you know, I wasn't very self-disciplined. I really needed that structure. I thought it would be very helpful. So that's a kind of thing you have to kind of think about yourself. How can you training, calming the mind, stimming the mind. Part of the training also in monasticism is a training in attitudes. We have attitude problems. You have an attitude problem. So one of the attitudes that we try to cultivate is contentment with little. It's called santati. That I found very, very valuable. Where you get given a little package, like the monastic guideline around food is that you, like in Thailand, we eat once a day, and you accept the food that's offered, right? And you try to reflect on the generosity of the laity, so you try to express thanks, and then you say it's good enough for the day, and you just have to make it till tomorrow. Yeah, so what I learned through that little structure was how to reflect rather than how to feel guilty. Because when I went into, say, Northeast Thailand, the food there was very coarse, and I was used to refined food, so I had a lot of problems with food. I was kind of, they say I was green for 2 years. Mm-hmm. My basic complexion was green. And I've got one picture when I was a novice. Wow, was I thin. I was really, really thin. So, you know, my mind was saying, hey, I'm dying. and I need pickles, or I need substantial food or something. Or whatever it was, and there's the food. You know, and I knew the lay people were very, very poor, and they were giving their very, very best. So I couldn't say, you know. And Ajahn Chah didn't hoard the food. You know, he didn't get all the goodies. Well, the senior monks sometimes got more cakes than me, but that was just, that's part of it. So then you'd have this food in front of you, which was basically like sticky rice and some chili and, you know, squashed frog and kind of some leaves, and maybe a mango, and that was it. And then you sit in front of your bowl and you look at your food and you just reflect, well, this food is medicine for the day. Just to carry me through for the day. That was the reflection. Then the reality was, where's the ice cream? I want a croissant. That was the greed mind. Or maybe it wasn't, it was the rational greed mind. I need brown rice. I can't do with white rice. You know, no way I'm going to survive on white rice. Or I need a balanced diet. Where's the vitamins? And the mind would kind of go on and on and on and on in this kind of endless complaint of discontent. And then the reflection would be content with little. And then the reflection became a mirror. At first I just felt guilty. Because I was really, really greedy for all kinds of food. Because I wanted something distracting. And this was such a undistracted life. So then, of course, I must be grateful. I must be content. And that's, of course, not contemplation. It's not cultivating a wholesome attitude. It's actually just cultivating guilt, which is not good. So the way of using like mirrors, so like the mirror was the attitude of content with little, and then the reality was the greed for other kinds of food, things that I was used to, and then the mirror of the reflection of be content, you know, this is good enough, you'll last till tomorrow, began to make me take responsibility for the greed or the discontent. And then I said, oh, that's discontent. That's what discontent feels like. Oh, yeah, there it is, yeah. And then I began to see how beautiful it was to say, well, it's good enough. You'll probably make it till tomorrow. And it was really lovely. And then every now and then you'd get someone from California coming in with his incredible ideas about macrobiotics and balanced diets, you know. And you'd see how much they'd suffer. And of course they were right. I mean, they were right about their diet and all that. But where are you going to get macrobiotics in Northeast Thailand? And you could see how much suffering they had because they perceived that the religious purity came through diet. Huh? Now the people who really suffered, of course, were the monks who had sickness. And usually they couldn't stay. It was just too tough. So we had one monk who had Crohn's disease, he couldn't stay. One monk who had hypoglycemia, couldn't stay. So they were, and it was good that they left, you know. So it was a very tough life, physically tough, but that's all that, you know, that's all the society had. It's like, you know, you just didn't have anything. So there are limits to that. Obviously, you can hurt yourself and so on. But So the reflection kind of became, well, am I strong enough? Maybe not. So a lot of monks left because of diet, because of that. But what I want to indicate is not so much around food, but it's just how you, when, if you cultivate a wholesome attitude, what happens to the mind? The mind can take a, it can be transformed. So we had the same reflection around robes, around our living space, and around medicine. Good enough. You know, so you get a hut, and of course, like in Ajahn Chah's monastery, there were maybe 30 of us, and there were 30 huts, each monk got a hut, and maybe 5 huts had mosquito screens. And there's malaria there. So of course, the greed mind says, how can I get a hut with mosquito screens? The reflection was, you've got a floor for the night, it's good enough. The greed mind says, yeah, but I'd like to. And it was amazing to see how my greed mind could find the most absurd things to be greedy about. It was not proud. I'd see a monk with a more brown robe and I'd want that. Yeah, just kind of, you know, totally sort of embarrassing kind of greed. Just watch that. But then the reflection was, no, it's just good enough. It's good enough. And that reflection is such a peaceful reflection, contentment with little. And if you think about our consumer culture, I'd be hung if I gave this kind of speech on CNN. Because consumer culture is doing the exact opposite. It's making you discontent, isn't it? And our economy is dependent on discontent. Pretty sick, really. It's really, you know, unemployment. Employment is dependent on discontent. It's really wacko, I think. But anyway, as a reflection, I found that so very helpful. And so I don't know, like, and so I've used that kind of a model for many kinds of things. I've used it for cynicism. So I've invented language for myself as a mirror for cynicism. Many kinds of things. So in that vein, in your own practice, are there attitudes of mind which continue to take you into suffering? You know, take you into whatever kind of negativity we get caught up into. And how can I awaken to those? And how can I train my mind? And Buddhism is about training the mind to not go down those avenues, those kind of sticky avenues that we get caught up into. And that's by creating reflective statements, reflective reminders. So I would just kind of come up like one. I often talk about. I came across that one: infinite patience, boundless compassion. I just stuck that up all over my walls, and every time I'd come in my room, you know, infinite patience, boundless compassion. And then it became a mirror. Where are you at? And I'm not patient, and I hate everyone. Okay, all right. So what does that feel like? Come back to that. So the mirrors weren't kind of things that, they weren't demands. Huh? They were reflections. And this is where when the spiritual life is just some kind of demand you put on yourself, then it's I call it the tyranny of goodness. You tyrannize yourself because you're not up to the mark. But that's not contemplative. That's just I should or I shouldn't be. So if you're doing that to yourself, that won't work because it's still ego. But if you see the movement of mind as some kind of negativity, and you see that awareness is not strong enough to know that, and you invent language or signs or symbols to help you to awaken to that, and then you can shift. So like let's say, as my mind began to complain about the food, I began to see that and saying, I don't want to live there. I don't want to live in that complaining mind. And then without repressing it, I could move, yeah, it's good enough. So that's not repression. It's just change. What is it? Cognitive behavior, one of those words, whatever. It's just shifting. It's shifting toward more wholesome attitude. And I mean, I have to keep doing that because my mind can go towards complaining. But I can do that, can't I? I can train the mind, shift the mind. So that was a big thing. Another big one is called Indriya Samvara. And Indriya Samvara is the sense restraint. And It's such a distracted society. We live in such an interesting society. We have so much interesting literature and so many interesting audio experiences and so many interesting video experiences and so many, you know, interesting people. The trouble with a mind which is always going out into sense experience is that it becomes addicted to that. And in Buddhism, the spiritual center is not an experience. It's that which knows experience. And I always come back to that, don't I? It's that awareness of the changing mode of experience. So if I'm always kind of looking for a sense experience, even if I think it's a spiritually sense, you know, a spiritual experience, I'm always looking for an experience outside of myself in terms of sights and sounds and so on, and I keep doing that, then I miss where the spiritual center is, which is not so much a spiritual, it's not a sense experience, it's knowing. The sense experience is changing. So sense restraint is very, very important in monastic life, and like I said, it was very boring. There wasn't anything to fill the mind, you know, to distract the mind. So I had to go through a lot of kind of like restlessness and impatience and so on. But what I found is when I didn't always, like when I felt bored, because I had very few objects to distract the boredom, admittedly, if a newspaper came into the morning, I gobbled it down. I was just voracious, I was so hungry for information. But it wasn't around. I had to look at that desire to always go out into experience, to read something, to talk with someone, to eat, you know, always this out, out, out. And I began to see that energy of going out, looking for something. And as I began to see that, I said, oh yeah, but that's restlessness. And that sense restraint was very helpful for just looking, looking, being, being, being. And then of course, the seemingly boring monastery became more beautiful. Began to notice the trees and notice the sky and actually notice that the teacher was really nice, because the need for some kind of sense experience was less and less. And I still work with that. I mean, I still have that kind of mind. So sense restraint. And how do you do that in modern urban society? Or do you even see the need of it? Which isn't to say that you can't use music in a good way. You can't use the visual arts in a good way. You know you can talk and all of that, but. If there is no sense of pausing, of restraint, then the mind gets very, very tired, very busy, very jaded. The third precept of Buddhism, which is usually pouched about to not be unfaithful in relationships, so it's usually around sexuality, it actually means to be restrained in the whole sense world. But that, again, it's not a moral judgment against these things. It's just seeing that our spiritual center cannot be, enlightenment cannot be that usual kind of sense experience. It has to be of a different quality, a whole different quality, which means it's like coming home, into samvara. So that's a huge one. So like any of you have done a long retreat. I just taught a retreat in this Thanksgiving in Winnipeg. And I said, it said to the retreatants, I said, you know, it's a shame it's only a 3-day retreat, because the goodies come on the fourth day. And if you've done a 10-day retreat, usually most people who haven't got a regular practice going, first 3 days, restlessness, dullness, memories of work, you know, falling about, and then that, because there are no distractions to that, you're not filling the mind, the mind's emptying out. People start to smile on the fourth day. They start to notice the clouds and trees. And that's a very interesting with sense restraint, that in the beginning it seems like less, not more, but then you see less is more. You know, it's because the mind begins to have some clarity. Now there's no answer to that. You can't kind of just sort of chuck everything out. But that the ability to like, limit the amount of sense input we have is very, very important. Very, very important. So I can, you know, I just want to watch people walking around with their headsets on, heads buried in their laptops, you know, always out. You know, the mind just gets tired and exhausted. Just exhausted. Obviously, the monastic life has a lot of moral principles, very, very strong moral principles that we live by. Not killing, so I'm not even allowed to cut plants. Not taking that which is not given, not stealing, celibacy, that's a huge sense restraint. Very, very, very difficult one to actually be mindful of sexuality, not repress it, but also have no avenue for it. Very, very difficult one, but very peaceful. Very, very peaceful. If you can get the sense of that's just an energy that goes through the body and mind. And I look at the sexual imagery that our culture promotes. It's very restless for the mind. Very, very restless. Not good for the mind. Because if you look at like sexual imagery, it either is it's pursuing that which stimulates sexual energy. So it's either a memory or it's an image. The image might be right there, it might be pictorial, whatever. So the mind is looking for the exciting sense object, which is fine, which is natural, right? But if our culture is always just promoting that, that's obviously not going to make the mind very peaceful. So kind of knowing what the mind does. So like monks have a rule, you can't take a second look. Great rule. You know, so some, you know, in a celibate community, this beautiful woman walks in, and they even, wow, because we're men. But you can't do it twice. And that's sense restraint. So and there's peaceful coexistence with that energy. You know, not saying it's right or wrong or whatever. And so you can see a culture which uses that all the time. And that's really, I mean, just at the level of doing that to women, that's not very, you know, not very healthy and so on. But just if you think about the spiritual life, that distraction of the mind, that's not going to really help it. So then right sexuality in lay life. I can't talk about that because I'm an expert in celibacy. That's how I've learned about sexuality. But to see that if that is something that preoccupies the mind all the time, that preoccupation precludes the ability to kind of really notice the silence of the mind. If one feels guilty about it, that also is a preoccupation. If one tries to repress it, that's also a preoccupation, right? So the kind of middle way of finding some kind of middle balanced way in relationships, and honoring that, honoring relationships, loving relationships, supportive relationships, and so on. Probably one of the, I guess this happens in any life, it just doesn't happen in monastic life, is just the whole thing of being defeated. Just, you know, kind of really, really trying hard in your meditation, you know, really kind of going at it, and then it just doesn't work. And I think that's a big switch for most meditators. It doesn't just have to be monastic. Is that change from willfully trying to get something to surrendering to the way things are, but with full mindfulness. And that, I know that took me a long time, not to just to keep trying to get the right state of mind, where the meditation becomes much more heartfelt, much more receptive, much more humble, all those attitudes. And that often comes from like a crisis. So my peers, you know, most of us have been through kind of really difficult crises. You know, just the stuff we've been through, and now just like talking to some senior monks, another senior monk is going through some crisis, and you know, what is that? I don't know. I mean, all the wisdom is there, all the practice is there, and just as some kind of karmic thing comes up, and the heart kind of breaks open or whatever. And those kind of crises times, if they're just externally, you know, like if you're getting burnt out, obviously you have to get out of there, or you just get more burnt out, right? So I'm not saying you just say, oh great, I'm having a crisis. You know, I'm going to get enlightened. I'm not saying that. But when they do come, and if you can get away with it without, fine. You don't. But what clicks in then? It seems to me all that other stuff clicks in. Your sitting practice clicks in. Your morality clicks in. Your spiritual friendships click in. Your your sense of why is, you know, investigation, that clicks in, all of that, which is the foundation of the practice. And then I think those which we call spiritual crises, maybe, they become very edifying. You know, and so the kind of really difficult parts I've been through in monastic life, I don't want to go through them again. Certainly, you know, oh great, I'm going to have another crisis. It's not. But because I think I had a foundation of practice, even though I thought I lost the plot, I really, you know, and I've lost it now. This is it. Something deeper is all saying, no, no, just be mindful. Bear with it. Bear with this difficulty. And then, so, you know, I've been through kind of really difficult, despairing things, but the whole practice of having cultivated these very ordinary things carries you. Your morality carries you through. Your meditation practice carries you. And then you oftentimes burn through stuff that may be very difficult. In kind of despairing or lonely kind of mind states that have no logical reason for being there. They're just there. And then there's tremendous openness of heart and strength of character and strength of practice, because one is able to do that. If you have no, you know, if you have no foundation, then quite often you just get blown away by that stuff. And then, you know, there's no real insight from it. So those are just a few of the themes that, you know, I know you can't shave your head, but it is interesting. These are the things that the Buddha said, you know, if you want to stick with me, you want to practice with me, this is the kind of stuff that I recommend. And so the whole life has evolved around that. Now, what he said to lay people was, you know, keep the precepts, you know, try to practice mindfulness, ethics, honor your elders, honor your kind of social agreements and all that. But he never really laid it out. Like, he didn't really lay out a Quran or a Talmud for the laity, because that was, because the lay life was so different from the monastic life. So it was more like general suggestion. Well, that was something to ponder. Any questions for anyone? Or other ideas? Or whatever? Suggestions? Yes? Boundless compassion. Boundless compassion. Infinite patience, boundless. It's a double whammy. Covers a lot. It does, doesn't it? Covers a lot. Please.
How did you reconcile the precept of not filling the alms giving that squash broadly?
Yeah. Well, it's quite important to consider that, because the precepts are about what your mind is doing. Okay, so. The first precept is the basic precept we have to the animal world of not killing. Then the precept, there's no precept about vegetarianism. Where vegetarianism comes in is more from altruism. So it's a sort of opposite side of not killing, where you make an economic decision not to follow greed. So if you look at what your mind is doing, like if you go to Loblaws and you want a turkey for Thanksgiving, you're not violent, you're greedy. Right? It's not like if you kill the turkey, it's different. But when you go Loblaws, oh, I'll have a butterball. You know, it's what if you look at your mind when you give that up and decide to have a, you know, tofu dinner, you're actually renouncing a bit of greed, because you've made, you know, because you're probably practicing altruism. So for the monastic community, this was actually a point of controversy that came up in the life of the Buddha. And there was a schism that was formed by a fellow called Devadatta, and he wanted to create a more ascetic order. So he said monks should practice vegetarianism, they should eat in forests, they should sleep in forests, they should never have a meal in lake of slums, all kinds of other rules. And the Buddha said, no, the monastic life is one of being grateful for what is offered, but if a lay person kills an animal for a monastic, then the monastic cannot accept that. So if the farmer says, I killed Charlie the chicken for you, you say, I can't have that. But if the farmer eats chicken curry, the monk accepts it with gratitude, because the monk has no power over money. Now, some people think we're quibbling there, but the way it actually works in Thailand, say, you wander through the village and people give, and you don't want to refuse that giving. So we had a kind of difficult decision to make, because we started up a very interesting experiment. We started up a monastery in northeast Thailand with Western monks, but in a traditional Thai culture. It's a fascinating kind of experiment. And in that, we knew that these villagers who had invited us were going to kill animals for us, because not only would we go on alms round, the villagers would also come to the monastery and make food. And we knew darn well that they'd be killing chickens. So we said to them, they have to serve vegetarian, right? But it wasn't because we were trying to make a preference for food. We knew they'd be doing that. But if anyone came from Bangkok, and people would come from Bangkok, you know, and they'd take the night train, go to the market and bring some food, if they brought meat, we said okay, because we won't accept their offering. So we kind of worked that out. So that's kind of specific to monasticism. But it's two things, isn't it? One is like the violence of killing, and then there's societal violence. And that we have to deal with more on an altruistic level. So that's the beauty of it. I can just say someone who doesn't want to be vegetarian, I can at least say, well, don't kill. Right? You can practice that, and they'll start to say, yeah, no, maybe I'll eat less meat because I don't like what the meat industry is doing. Yeah. Now, historically what happened is that when Buddhism went to, I think I got it right, when it went to China, Taoism was very influenced by China. Buddhism was influenced by Taoism, and the monastics there became vegetarians, right? So the Chinese monastics think we're abominable, because we, you know, there's a sort of cultural differences there. So you have economic choices. Yeah, you make the choices you want to make. So like people will practice, they'll say, well, okay, when I buy food, I won't eat meat, but if, you know, if I go to auntie's and she's having whatever, I'll accept it because I want her. Oh, but some people just practice strict vegetarianism. People do it different ways. Yes, sir, in the back there.
You mentioned at the beginning of your talk feeling surrounded by deviance and inherent violence.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that?
Well, I just turn it on and off. So I kind of look at it more as an anthropologist. I mean, I have a lot of choice. I don't really need to know anything. So I kind of, well, partially I watch television with my mother to keep her company. So that's part of my giving practice, my service practice. And we both just complain about television usually. I try to see what issues are going on, like around. I try to watch like how politics is used. Like I found it interesting how politicians use hatred and fear, and how they divide society. I kind of like to look at how that works, and then talk about that maybe. So all these religious issues, I kind of ponder. Well, what, you know, what's going on here? So I kind of look at that, but I just pick it up and put it down. So if my mind's just getting too busy, I just don't look at the stuff, really. Because I don't really need to be that informed on a lot of things. So I guess, in terms of sense restraint, I really limit the amount of input I put in terms of concepts. And that I notice in the sitting. Yeah, because I sit every morning, and then maybe midday sometimes. But it's very obvious to me when there's just too much information. Because my mind feels it all, so then I know I'll just, you know, stop reading so much. So for me, the silence is a monitor of what's being accumulated in consciousness. A lot of people just don't read newspapers now, I find. They just kind of really, really kind of limit it. And I think that's great. It's interesting. But then if you want to be socially active, you have to be informed. And if you want to be involved in public life, then you really need to be informed. So if you do it as an act of compassion, then that's very skillful, to be informed, to be a part of public life. Anything else? Or? Yes?
Thank you, Ajahn, for a very clear some clarity about monastic life. But I'm a lay person, I'm thinking about left her back on the shore. Are you still carrying?
Yeah, that's an old story.
So I was thinking, what does it mean for us to experience sensory perception with complete validity or whatever? Does it mean we can go and experience what we do it mindfully, with no grasping, with no ego reinforcement, with clarity? There are many things which are to be experienced, especially what you said, if we're talking service, social service, seva, whatever. We can go and do that, and we will be influenced with what we will experience many different things. But how do we do so rightfully?
Well, that's your problem, isn't it? That's why I don't legislate that. And that's what I was just saying. I'm just saying this is the way the Buddha suggested his community live, right? So I throw it back to you, and you figure it out. You know, I mean, if you can watch pornography 20 hours a day, go for it. But I don't suggest you do it. If you can just fill your mind with television 20 hours, go for it. But there is sense restraint, isn't there? Right? I mean, that's a part of any kind of human life, right? But there's also the necessity for engaging in life, right? I mean, you have to. I mean, I have to. As an abbot of a monastery, I'm always going to committee meetings and doing all of that. So the most important thing is to develop a good center, right, which you get from the sitting practice and so on, a good center. But the trouble is, many people don't have a good center, and they get drawn out, and then they get addicted to being drawn out, and then they find, like, this is kind of classic, is people who, like, leave a retreat, they get a sense of, wow, that composure is really nice, and then they start to get distracted through kind of a lot of sense input, and then they can't sit anymore. You know, after like maybe half a year, they're doing like 5 minutes a day, and they'll say, well, I'm busy. Well, I can't quite believe that you can't get a half hour a day, right? But I think the problem there is that the mind becomes so jaded through sense experience, to settle down again, you have to go through that kind of restlessness. And all of us, of any discipline, you know, whether it's yoga or music, if you don't stay with it, right, then you get kind of rusty, and then it's hard to do it again. So I don't know how you have to live in the world. You know, you have your children, you have your family, and so on and so forth. But is there a place for Indriya Sangvara? You know, and the Buddha says there is. There is a place for sensory, and he makes it very, very, very fundamental to monastic life. Now, that doesn't mean, so monastics might get repressed about it, but that's not what the Buddha was teaching. You know, he wasn't saying get uptight about it. So those stories, they're all very nice and good, but what I find about them is they're too zen. You know, you can get very zen about, you know, or it's just be free, or, you know, but there is something about integrity and sense. You know, there's a whole training of the mind that the Buddha offered, right? And I think modern culture, It's a bit like, I was watching BBC with Mum yesterday. One of the things I saw, I saw two people from Amaravati. That was mind-blowing. Two people I know very well on BBC. Anyway, one of the commentators was saying that Catholics now practice cafeteria Catholicism. Right? With a little bit of this, you know, a little bit of this, and a little bit. And I think there is a danger of kind of picking up that which you like in the spiritual disciplines that are going, right? So if you like the Zen story, which kind of suits that, and you like the Sufi story and all that, but what is it about let's say children? You know, you just have to give yourself to children. What is it about a life of like real dedication? You have to give up a lot, right? And I think those kinds of stories somehow, I think, dismiss that life of training which is necessary for the spiritual life, like renunciation and all of that. And they're clever, but I always think, if I say that to a junior monk, you know, if I why don't you go practice in Soho? You know, yeah, just practice something, just you can be mindful in Soho. I know darn right that junior monk can't do it, because it, you know, because lust is too powerful an energy. I know he has to, he needs a kind of containment. Or if I say to a monk, you can just be mindful and be the abbot of the monastery. You know, I know that's not true. So there is a place for, there is a place for discipline. You know, there is a place for restraint. And the Buddha certainly, I mean, you know, he really recommended those things. So sometimes I think in our modern culture we get very iconoclastic, right? And it's a sort of no rule society, which is maybe a throwback to the sort of Victorian ideas we had. But you can get too laissez-faire. You can get too sort of indulgent or whatever, I feel. So I mean, I know what you're pointing to, but I don't resonate with that stuff quite often. Or like the Zen story where a Zen monk gets hit in the head with a bamboo stick, right? And he's enlightened. What you don't read is about that he's been practicing for 40 years. And, you know, and his abbot's been telling him to, you know, meditate in the cold. You don't get all that context in it. Any others? Anything else? Yes.
You mentioned that the reflection when you are aware of this attempt led you to take responsibility for it. Does that result in the two things happening? One, that this contempt arises less frequently, less forcefully. So we have a lot of capacity for it. But then also, when it does arise, more capable and powerful.
Exactly. You both don't proliferate on it,
yeah.
Plus you notice it more quickly, so its power to delude you gets less and less and less. And that's what mindfulness is. It's like really being on the job, and the less you proliferate, the less you're going to create around that. A mood creates a thought. A thought creates a habit. Habit creates character. Character creates personality. Right? So the mood of discontent arises. I start to think, you know, discontent thoughts. I create habitual discontent thoughts. I become a whinging character, and my whole life is a whinge. Right? So any mood, but then I break that, I don't make the thought, then I don't make the habit, I don't make the character, I don't make the personality. It's just pretty logical, isn't it, how the mind works. Yeah?
That's a great feeling.
Oh, it's great. Mm-hmm. You kind of, what else is it? And then you can just sit. You don't have to watch television. Now once you get your sitting practice down, you know, you really get into the heart and you get into the silence of the mind. I mean, it's just so nice. You really want to do that. And then the other seems so gross, really. So kind of like that. That's why we stress samadhi a lot. You know, like the stillness of the mind to give you that contrast to the mind, which is, you know, off a bit. Won't keep it. Shall we finish with a chant? Reflections on sharing blessings. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent, or hostile, may all
to receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and to realize the deathless through the goodness that arises from my practice. And through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nibbana in every kind of birth. May I have an upright mind with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. Unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble lord. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled.
Let me finish with the closing homage here.
Well,